If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Welcome to our podcast,
Life After the Letters. I'm Amelie.
And I'm Suba.
We're friends that met whilst working our first shifts as junior doctors.
And we're here to talk about the stories and challenges that we face every day.
Hello, Amelie.
Hello, Suba. I can't even excitement in my voice because we've been playing around and messing around for the past 37 minutes to be exact, because Suba can't research how to set up an international Skype recording conversation.
Because Amelie is the most tech phobic person who's there like, but it doesn't work on this and I can't figure out how to do this on that.
Apple for 3 years, don't you know?
So can we just talk about the miracle of technology that I'm literally on the other side of the world in New Zealand and Amelie is in the UK and we're currently both online recording a podcast together?
But let's also talk about the tragedy that there's no time travel, because it's currently 6:38 a.m. My voice is gone and Suba's living her best life, about to do a Game of Thrones listening party. So I don't know, it sounds a bit unfortunate.
Yeah, but also, Amelie, there is a positive to it being 6:30 in the morning. Your voice is sounding real low.
Damn, Daniel. Sexy voice on.
Yes, husky.
So, guys, we thought, okay, let's bring you an episode on New Zealand and what it's like to, I was going to say intercalate, but what it's like to do your FE abroad or take years out of training. So we're both taking probably 2 years out of training. Suba might magically next week, who knows. But let's talk about New Zealand. So Suba, how are you finding it?
Mate, it's such a good life out here. It's great. It's kind of one of those things where, like, if I didn't have so much tying me to the UK, I could genuinely imagine staying here and living here.
So that's absolutely mad. I've seen pictures of you surfing and that's literally shook me to the core.
Who am I? I don't even know myself anymore. I'm like finding it. I'm eat, pray, loving out here. Like I'm Julia Roberts now. I'm Julia Roberts, okay?
When you went to New Zealand, how did you find it then? And like, what was your journey in New Zealand like?
So I think that, and I think this is a fantastic thing with F1 and F2, that because we move and you rotate and you change hospitals and you change groups of mates and, like, you know, you learn to become so adaptable. And so I felt like coming over here, obviously I was nervous, but there was a large part of me that was like, yeah, the first month might be like rough in that I don't know what to do, I don't know where to go, I don't know how things are done here, and then I'll just get used to it.
Yeah, no, I totally get you. But you and Claire, you didn't actually have accommodation to start with, did you?
No, so there was a lot of things that were up in the air, but that's a huge part of just like moving to another part of the world, isn't it?
Yeah,
so
exactly.
But we kind of had a strategy of like starting on an Airbnb, trying to find a place out here, trying to get life sorted, getting settled into the new job, getting used to how they do things out here. All of that sort of stuff obviously kind of happened in the first month or so.
Yeah.
Kind of finding your feet kind of happens quite early on.
Good, good. But you feel like you found at work as well?
Yeah, I think for sure now. I definitely would say I have.
There's like 3 months later or 4 months later.
Yeah, it's 3 months down the line. Isn't that crazy?
Actually madness.
It is. It is.
Cool.
Anyways, give us a quick run through of what you've been up to.
So currently I am living, I was going to say a nomadic life, but that's totally not the word. So I've been out of London, and anything out of London is just a bit scary for me.
Is nomadic to you? You're now in Outer Mongolia in your teepee.
Traveling through. No, I'm literally living and working in Devon at the moment. So I pretty much, I thought I was coming to do an acute medical job. So the funny thing with agencies is that they like schmooze you so much. They'll be like, oh, this is the money we'll get you. This is the accommodation we'll get you. This is what your new job will be. And then you go and you sign your contract and you're like, okay, cool. I'm going to do an acute job, because an acute job is the easiest thing just to like jump into, isn't it?
Yeah, anywho, for sure.
Lady Noosa, she rocks up on her first day. And turns out it's not an acute job. And I was like, oh my gosh. So, and I've signed a contract, bear in mind, that says an acute job. So anyway, she's like, so you're not actually starting there. You're going to be doing medicine. And medicine is so annoying because it's such a vast thing. Like, you could be doing anything. I could be like chilling in a derm clinic or a rheum clinic. Or I could be breaking my back on gastro. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, wow. So they move you like from ward to ward.
So that's what she said on the first day, that she was actually going to move me and I was going to be the fillet inner, which made me like nearly cry, because I don't want to be fillet inner. Because they tend to do a bulk of the work. Like, you'll always have busy days because you're not, you're on an understaffed ward. Anyway,
and you're always covering gaps, aren't you? So you're always busy.
Exactly. So I was about to have like a nervous breakdown, but I was like, okay, no, let them just think that you're like a calm, nice person. So anyway, I rock up and I've been on the same ward since I started, which has been 3 weeks now. So I've been on a respiratory ward, and it's just to help the juniors, because the juniors were finding it quite stressful not having enough people. And now it almost feels like once you have one more doctor, it's too many people. Mm. But I'm not complaining about that at all. But back to
you. Okay.
Because we'll talk about my journey later.
And we will.
So Suba, when did you start thinking initially about going to New Zealand? And were you thinking of other options at the time? Were you thinking about going in straight into training? What was your thought process?
So for me, it goes back to like pretty much being second year at med school. I remember hearing for the first time from like, I think like a friend of mine who was final year or like fourth year,
okay,
who told me about the concept of F3. And it's like, you know, when someone like upgrades your life for you, like the first time someone told me about the beauty blender, or like the first time someone told me that you should use it like damp as opposed to just like dry. And you're like,
game changer.
Or the first person who, I'm sorry, I don't know who you are anymore, but like who showed me what pesto was. And I was like, what?
Wow.
What have I been doing my whole life? I've been eating nuts, olive oil and basil separately. I could have been blending it and putting it on my pasta, but you know, so.
Rubbing it up.
Yeah, so that was me as a second year at med school, when someone in their final year was like, oh, F3, it's a thing where like after you do F1 and F2, you go traveling or you go abroad and you can work in different places. And they were planning to do Australia. And I was like, oh, I'd love to visit that part of the world, like Australia, New Zealand, that side of the world would be amazing. And a friend of mine was like, oh yeah, New Zealand's actually like this new place that everyone goes to and like blah, blah, blah. And I was like, oh, that sounds really cool.
Australia back in the day, didn't they? And I think it's only more recent that everyone's like going to New Zealand.
Exactly, yeah. Because Australia has been kind of like the go-to spot for ages. Yeah, but in like probably the last 3-4 years, I feel like New Zealand's really boomed in popularity.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that was the first time it kind of came across me. Like it came to my mind. And I pretty much made up my mind that day that I was definitely doing an F. Absolutely, I was doing an F3. Absolutely. And that just keeps expanding now, doesn't it? F4, F5.
It's getting risky.
And it was kind of like probably over the last couple of years, definitely in final year, I was kind of like, New Zealand kind of appeals to me more, because Australia was quite oversubscribed and it sounded like it would be quite difficult to get the sort of job you wanted and the place you wanted.
Mm-hmm.
That New Zealand kind of started to appeal to me a bit more.
I see. And kind of thinking, you know, when you're like, okay, New Zealand's gonna be much easier, let me start researching about New Zealand, what that looks like, and you start to get excited by a new place.
Yeah. And the more you look into it, the more you're like, oh, they have this and there's that. And that's really cool. And then also a big deciding factor for me between Australia and New Zealand was the fact that New Zealand doesn't have anything that can kill you. Whereas Australia has, you know what? Everything is trying to end your life. Like, you go to put on your shoes and you get bitten by a snake or something, you know? Like, that's not the life I'm trying to lead.
No, no.
That's not why my parents came to the UK, you know?
Just like, we can go to New Zealand and be gone. No. That's not the one.
Yeah. No, that's not the one to try and put on your slippers and you die. Like, that's not
the one. So no. Are there other people who are just not F3s? So do people come to New Zealand at different times of their lives?
Yeah, absolutely. So actually there's a lot of consultants that move out here.
Okay.
That come out here with their families after having worked in the UK for like 10 years as a consultant and come out here to continue their careers. Yeah, there's lots of there's so many people actually. There's to the point where sometimes I get confused as to whether I'm in New Zealand or if I'm in the UK. There's so many Brits out here. So that's quite an experience, particularly midwives. There's a lot of British midwives here.
Oh, interesting. That's really cool. It's great that these options exist for other people who are outside of doctordom and also at different stages of their lives.
Yeah, 100%.
And do you think that made it easier for you to like assimilate, or was it because they were very similar systems that allowed you to assimilate?
So, I mean, yeah, it's a multifactorial thing, I think, coming to feel comfortable here. Firstly, of course, it's it's a public healthcare system for the majority. It is half private, half public, so as to speak. But secondary care is publicly funded. So it's very similar to being back home. Secondly, there's so many of the staff are British, so it just feels very familiar.
Give me a percentage of how many staff are British.
Genuinely, I would say maybe like 60-40, like 60 Kiwi, 40 British.
That's mad.
It's huge.
That's crazy.
I've been in conversations where with people, like just by chance in terms of like who's around, and we've all just been British, and you're like, oh, this is weird.
That's so weird. But I suppose that's also the beauty of being able to have like free travel and to be able to easily pick up, move and work in New Zealand or Australia. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
Visa nonsense, or to figure out whether your family will be able to come and meet you. Like so many like immigrants in the UK.
Yeah, exactly.
Interesting.
No, it is actually quite mental. You really become conscious of like that privilege that you have.
Yeah.
But also it's the other side of it I was going to say is that the kind of people that are drawn to New Zealand from the UK are quite similar, so it's been really easy to get on with the Brits that you do meet here, because you've kind of been drawn to this place rather than Australia, and you're kind of on a similar wavelength somehow. Okay. So it's quite nice.
So what do you think like the characteristics of your lot in New Zealand are?
So the people that kind of come to New Zealand are definitely like absolutely in love with the outdoors, so love nature, love the outdoors.
Yeah.
Slightly on the more hipster side of life, like, you know, appreciate the finer things, particularly also the Aucklanders, because I'm obviously in Auckland, so
yeah.
The people that then choose to come and live in the city kind of like want the city life, love having like a good meal out, love a good coffee, like, you know, kind of like that side of things too. So it's kind of, and like everyone's quite friendly, like if you've upped and moved across the world to move your life, like you're quite a sociable person, like,
yeah,
you know, so
you have to,
everyone out here
as well, don't you, because you have to make new friends.
Exactly, so everyone's like just very willing to say hello and be helpful and be friendly, so it's really nice. It's lovely.
And can I ask, would you say that's just in the hospital, or is that also outside? Because obviously people who are newly in a country, of course they're going to be open, but how have you found it interacting with people who are Kiwi, essentially?
I would say that the Kiwis are quite relaxed, like they're really quite chilled out, and they are friendly. I was gonna say, even out and about, popping into shops and things like that, everyone's always been quite friendly and chatty. But I would say that's actually not dissimilar to London. But in the hospital, the culture is a bit different to, I would say, back home. But that's also probably to do with the fact that there's like a lesser degree of stress and pressure.
Yeah, and
so
I think also we've been working in like basically London hospitals or like London adjacent hospitals. And like, even for me, I'm in Devon now, literally it blows my mind. Can I just tell you something? Because whenever it happens, it makes me so shook in the hospital. My consultant, whenever she's like, oh, okay, we need to request this scan for this patient, then I'll go and see this woman and she is filling out the form herself and then she'll go and discuss the scan.
What? Your consultant?
Consultant. And then also, like, if she's referring a patient from clinic to the ward,
she'll clock them.
Listen, the patient will come up with a filled out drug chart and, like, everything will be filled out. Anticoagulation will be done. PRP medications will be done. Everything will be signed. There'll be a check against their allergies. And then she will give me a call before I even know the patient's up to say what exactly is going on. And then I'm like, no, let me do something. Let me clock them. And she's like, okay, but I've done their bloods, I've taken a sputum culture, and I've done cultures. And this woman has literally done it herself.
I'm shooketh.
Super. I think it's London. I think London's definitely mad.
Yeah. We've also definitely, that's difficult, isn't it? Because we've definitely worked in a bubble of being in, like,
high pressure,
like London hospitals, high pressure hospitals, like,
yeah, and our hospitals, you know, were like understaffed and they were like just about keeping it together.
Understaffed and oversubscribed. That's our hospital.
Yeah, literally both of them, isn't it? Mad, mad.
Yeah.
Oh. And are you feeling homesick at all? That's what I wanted to know.
So I'm a bit of a strange person because I don't generally get like that homesick even when I'm traveling.
See, but I just asked, did you miss me and you just ignored me?
No, wait. Let me get to it. Because obviously, like, I miss my family and all of my friends, including you. And I love that I had to clarify that you are my friend. But you know what really got me, though, was I was on Facebook and I saw a... Because I think it's also easy to kind of, like, not focus on that. But I saw a video of someone filmed Oxford Street, like, Christmas lights through a London bus as it was just, like, going down the road. And I literally, like, got really emotional. I was like, oh my God, it's home. And I really missed that. Because also for us, it's summer. Like, for us at the moment, it's spring turning into summer. So... Mm-hmm.
And also for you, you've literally been brought up in London and you've studied here and you've worked here. It's not like you've even had time out of London. So that must be such a change.
Yeah, I think it's just missing, like, because I think I really attach to like places as opposed to necessarily people. So seeing like a place really brought that memory back to me. I was like, oh, I really miss it.
Aww. Isn't that so interesting? That this is so different as well. So what do you plan on doing over your Christmas break?
So, well, I luckily am not working Christmas.
Nice.
And Claire, so Claire's, I don't think we've mentioned Claire before. Or have we mentioned?
Maybe briefly, but continue.
Okay, well, Claire was our housemate from F1 and she's my friend that I've come out to New Zealand with. So Claire's sister is coming over.
Oh, lovely.
And there's obviously a couple of us out here who don't have anyone or like don't have plans. So we're all going to get together and probably have a little Christmas meal and then go to the beach.
Oh, that's so cool.
It's literally going to be the height of summer. So we're just going to go to the beach because that's what you do in Auckland. You just go to the beach.
Oh, that's amazing.
It's going to be great. Yeah, so I want to make a nut roast because I've never made one before. And then one of our mates is going to make like a proper roast, meaty roast.
Lovely, lovely.
And then, yeah, so it'll be nice.
Oh, that's wicked. And so, okay, let's take it a step back. So, little year two medical student, Suba, has heard about this life-changing plan of being able to go to New Zealand in F3 year or different times in your training. Continue up until... final year and you're holding this like dream in your head. When is it that you have to start applying and when is it that, what do you have to like look out for?
So there's a couple of decisions to be made and that kind of starts with when you want to come to New Zealand or go abroad. For New Zealand, their training year runs from November to November as opposed to ours, which is obviously August to August.
Okay.
And I believe Australia runs February to February, but don't quote me on that. So initially we were sort of thinking of applying, well, I was quite keen to apply from November to November, but I was speaking to Claire and she initially thought she wanted to come back to start in August next year.
Okay.
So for her, she wanted to sort of, she'd rather work August to August. So that was fine for me. So then we kind of had to apply earlier. So to get a November job, you apply in April. So we sort of started looking for jobs around December, January time, but nothing was really coming up. And there's actually a website they have called Kiwi Health Jobs, which kind of posts posts jobs up, but also you can directly email, you know, the recruiters and just say, you can, exactly. So directly to the hospitals, like staffing people, you just get in touch with them and say, look, I'm interested in a job that starts at this time, blah, blah, blah.
Amazing. So it's not like you're emailing a locum agency and you're trying to select between the best agency. You're trying to focus going by the location you want to be and the job you want to do.
Exactly. So, I mean, you can do it the other way. I do know people that went directly through locum agencies, but I don't know if they had much luck. And I think also it gives you a bit more control to just sort of, if you know where you want to be, and me and Claire kind of had quite a candid chat about where we'd like to live. Mm. And for me, it was just, I wanted to live by the sea. And Claire was quite keen on living in a city. And I was kind of like, yeah, to be honest, you know what? I don't think I could hack living in not a city. Mm-hmm. So we both kind of agreed on Auckland. It kind of was the obvious choice. I was kind of caught between Auckland and another place called Tauranga, but we chose Auckland in the end. So once we'd chosen Auckland, well, then it was quite simple because there's just one place that you got in contact with. And Auckland has a really good website that's really like got a really good procedure on how to apply and get a job. So we just kind of went through that process. So we applied in February and they got back to us quite quickly. So we heard back from them in March, had our interviews in March and got our job offers in April, I believe.
That's crazy. That's such a quick, well, it's such a quick and like detailed process. But it's also, like it's very clear and easy to follow. So that's brilliant.
Yeah.
Because for some reason, I don't know why, this could have just been me thinking weirdly. But remember applying for electives as a medical student? Like, it took so
long. Oh, yeah.
Sometimes you'd have to apply like literally years in advance.
And it was such a pain because you'd email this one person or have to like phone them at like their time and beg them for like a place. Life.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. It was. And you'd feel like you kept having to spend money as well because you'd have to like book it or like put down money to confirm it and stuff, you know, stuff like that, which was stressful.
It's actually so long. Where did you go for your elective? I forgot.
I did Philippines and Malaysia.
Oh, yes, you did. And I did Cape Town, and I'm going back to Cape Town in 2 weeks. And I went
Cape Town is literally Amelie's favourite place. You've inspired me to go there because you go on about it so much.
I literally can't wait. But you have to take me with you. You can't just be going by yourself.
Yeah, of course. You've got to show me around.
And I feel like in the similar way that New Zealand is so like outdoorsy and you can really enjoy hiking and you can enjoy surfing, but you can still like do the whole city thing. Go out
and
wine, indulge in coffee, indulge in like just like the best.
Those finer things. Finest.
That's what Cape.
Yeah.
So you can do your bougie life, but you can do your like nature life as well. And that's...
Those are literally the best places. And also you're by the sea. And I think it just makes me so happy to like look out and see this huge body of water and like what you're like, you know, 20 minutes away from a beach. Like it's amazing.
That's so dope. And I think actually what's funny, I am in Devon at the moment and I think I've just come to Devon at the wrong time of year because I'm living with a couple, a really sweet couple, and they're so cool. And they've like made me feel really welcome. And they're young and they own their own house, but that makes me jealous. But anyway.
Goals.
I'm like, goals? You guys don't even know. Anyway, so I was just sitting with the guy and he was saying about how Devon's so good in the summer because like in the evening you can just go straight to the beach. You can just like chill on the beach all the time with your friends. You can go surfing. And he talked about how much the outdoor life is what brings people to Devon and how it's such a shame that we just don't have it in the winter. So I'm
just led
to what you have now.
Yeah, that is a shame that you've come, like the timing of it is a shame.
But it must be so amazing to have nature that's so close to you in New Zealand.
Yeah.
And all year round.
Yeah, absolutely.
And do you have any travel plans this year or are you just going to stay in New Zealand?
No, so I haven't got travel plans. So, I mean, obviously I've got to visit the Pacific Islands. Like, they're on my doorstep.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't wait to be living my best life in, like, Fiji or, like, Samoa or, you know.
How much are flights?
Well, I mean, relatively speaking, obviously in my head, I probably should stop doing this, but I still keep comparing everything to the UK.
Mm-hmm.
And it also helps that like their currency is double our currency. So if I'm like, oh, it's $80, I'm like, but it's only £40. And I know that maths is really illogical, but I'm like, oh, but it's only £40 for a banana. Like, no, it's not.
The things aren't.
But yeah, no.
Are they?
Produce is expensive here.
Okay.
Like it's got to be very seasonal, whereas in the UK, I think we're spoiled because of having Europe so close by. So we are spoiled, whereas here it's like, it's only really what's seasonal that you can like really afford to eat. Otherwise, obviously they're shipping it, which is kind of good. It makes you conscious of like how much is going into getting you this food. Like,
totally.
It's insane that we can have blueberries and strawberries at any time of the year, like in the UK, and it doesn't cost that much. It doesn't cost that much more.
Yeah. No, not at all. But that is definitely a good thing, because actually when you're talking about planetary health,
absolutely,
and like the environment, it's very important. We are eating like what's sustainable and things that aren't costing absolute like millions, and also lots of fuel to be able to transport from Spain to the UK.
100%, like the carbon emissions associated with what you eat, you're just not really conscious of. But because of cheap flights, like you're not aware of it because the cost isn't transferred to you that much. Whereas here, you pay an arm and a leg for like something that's not seasonal and isn't grown locally, so it just encourages you to eat locally, so it's quite good.
Exactly. And you know, when you're spending a lot of money, it makes you more conscious about the food that you're eating. You're not just chucking away because it costs £1 for a pack of bananas or something. Do you know what I mean?
But going back to your question about is it going to be cheap to fly to the Pacific, it's about like £200 for a flight there and back, which isn't the cheapest, but relatively speaking, it's like the cheapest it's ever going to be for me to fly there, so there you go. Yeah,
in your life, you might as well. That's wicked. And Claire's got family coming out to see her. Do you have any friends coming out to see you, or are they all shady like me going to Cape Town instead?
So my friends are coming just around New Year's, and they're going to be here for a couple of weeks in January. So I'll get to do some traveling with them. And then another friend of mine will hopefully be coming out a bit later in the year. Me and Claire are also going to Sri Lanka in February for her friend's wedding.
Oh,
yeah. And then my parents are going to meet us there, and then we'll do some traveling around Sri Lanka. It's going to be great. And I feel like it's going to be like, you know, Romesh Ranganathan when he goes to Sri Lanka with his mum. But in my mind, that's what I imagine. But in reality, it's going to be like, it's just going to be my parents making me and Claire go to like temples and stuff.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
I'm sorry.
That's it. I actually love him. I think he's just the funniest.
He's so great. Have you heard his podcast about hip hop?
Yeah, but I've listened to a couple of episodes. I love hip hop, and I love hip hop history as well. So he's so dope, and he's cool. I just find every Tamil person I've met, I just think that your sense of humor is so good.
Oh my god, thank you. Did you just say that my sense of humor was good? I feel like that's the nicest thing you've ever said to me.
I made a generalization, like a. I'm not sure if it's a good job.
This is why all stereotypes are bad.
I feel like someone could have taken that so out of context. I may find more people funny. Like, you think it's part of the culture or?
Absolutely. I think also maybe it's like a very, I don't mean to get political, but you know, like, I think when people go through struggles, right? Like, you turn to, you need humour to like get through life.
It's like, which company it is that does it, but there's this like list of like a happy index. It might even be like the happiness company, and it always comes to the top. It's always like Nigeria and other like poor countries that has like really bad wealth disparity. And they're always like, it must be,
it's
just
you're
because
struggling.
You have to
absolutely, you're struggling, and the only way you can just survive it is to at least laugh about it. So
just life is funny. So super, obviously we've been keeping in contact to make sure like the podcast is still like popping and up, and also just to like make sure we're posting on social media, even though we're kind of bad at doing that as well. I remember reading the post that you wrote, and it was about how you've just come into like decision making about your career. And can you give us a little bit of info on what that means for you? Because actually, you can say this better than I can.
So I know we've had like so many conversations about this sort of stuff. So I feel like it's so hard to make a decision about your career and your specialty in medicine.
You like everything, and we enjoy aspects of every job.
Exactly,
that
and that's because I think we're both like really curious people. So you know, you can find a genuine interest in anything you're doing. But I think it's so much pressure and stress to feel like you have got to make the right decision for yourself. So I feel like I kind of went on a deep soul search over the last couple of years, trying to get to the bottom of like, what is it that I love about medicine? And what is it that's going to keep me doing this job for the rest of my life? And what's going to really enrich and nourish my soul? And that kind of brought me to like two places that were both actually very unexpected for me compared to say when I was at medical school. And I was kind of choosing really at the heart of it between doing obs and gynae and palliative care.
This is more recent, isn't it? Because in med school, I don't know if you remember, but when you and Claire first joined us in our F1 year, you both said that you wanted to do surgery. I remember that blew my mind because I was like, how is it that all these girls from London, because I'd met loads of girls from London med schools who'd all wanted to do surgery, and I think I had just been in areas where there weren't very many female surgeons. So it literally blew my mind, and I was like, oh my gosh, I've been thinking wrong about everything.
I mean, I came in sort of toying between, I was actually toying between gen surge and psychiatry when I started F1 and F2, because I'd kind of come from, like, I did a psychology BSc. I've always had a huge interest in like psychiatry. I'm so fascinated with it, as are you. Like, we love psychology and psychiatry and that side of things. But I feel like in final year, I found that like I'm a very practical person as well, and I love the thought of developing a technical skill. And that's where I was drawn to surgery. But when I did my surgical job, I felt like there was kind of a connection or something I was kind of seeking that was missing.
Like a people connection.
And it wasn't that I didn't have like connections with my patients, but there was something there that just wasn't quite clicking. And I loved, because I did breast surgery, and I loved my job, and I loved going to breast clinic. But still there was something there that just wasn't quite connecting. And then I did ONG, which is my first F2 job, and I absolutely loved it. I think it was the most that I'd connected with patients. And the medical side of it was quite like a steep learning curve. But I, as patients wise, I connected the most with that cohort of patients. I loved that they were like women, generally actually not that far off from my age, that I really related to. And it was, we were talking about very personal things that like were, that I felt like I could understand. When someone was telling me about their heavy bleeding or telling me about their pelvic pain, I felt like such a connection to what they were telling me. And even the obstetric patients where I couldn't truly relate to, but I could imagine, you know, or like, I felt like we were connected in some way.
These people, like, they're your sisters, they're your mothers.
People that you're
going through.
Exactly. People that you've not known, but actually in ways you've known with through other forms. Like, it was beautiful. I felt like I really loved that side of it. And then
quickly. So my friend that I went to go and visit last week in Prague, so we met at first year university and we were in halls together. We were really close. Anyway, I went to go and see her last week and she's given birth to a baby around 6 months ago. And she was telling me there was such a difference that she felt when she was connecting with like other women as opposed to like young male doctors. And not to say it was because they were male or anything, but she felt as though with this one woman in particular, she was able to talk to her about different aspects of her life. Also the difficulty and the stigmas that she feels that when walking around being pregnant and people are like, oh, your husband probably looks after you. When she's like, no, I pay for my car. Like she scratched her car and then loads of people kept asking her, oh, have you told your husband yet? And stuff like that. And she was like, for goodness sake, I'm the one that's carrying us through. But the stigma she was able to discuss with her female doctor that she found so nice, as opposed to her male doctor later on, who was like, basically she was very late and he kept saying, oh no, just have sex, drink some red wine and the baby will come out. And she was like, that's not the conversation I'm trying to have. But I think that was just like a silly boy, not like most of your male really experienced obstetrician doctors.
I think it's nice that patients, I guess, also feel that connection on the receiving end. But also, like, I feel like I'm always in awe of like the female patients that I treat. Like, they're so strong. Like, how it blows my mind when I'm like, women just go through so much tragedy and are just tragedy that they face in their personal lives and difficulties that so many women have that we don't always talk about, like the number of women that have had miscarriages and come out the other end and carry on with life. Like, it must be so hard. Like, it really, like, I'm in awe. I'm so inspired by the women that like I treat. I love that as well. I think I find it really inspiring. So that's always great. And I think also in ONG, like, there's so many strong female consultants and registrars that also inspire me. So that's also a lovely side of it that I think I find really encouraging. So I was kind of caught between ONG and palliative care, and palliative care came to me because I feel like I loved how holistic it was. It was about this whole person. It wasn't about their disease. It was about the whole of this person and like their life and what matters to them, and that the fact that they are gonna die, and we're all technically gonna die, right? But like, their death is imminent, is now making them consider their life in a very different way. And I loved that there was aspects of psychiatry, general medicine, and just communication, and so many aspects of you that you had to bring to the table to be a good palliative care doctor.
And did you think that you came into this understanding after you did your palliative placement week, or was this kind of what you were just developing in your F1, F2?
I was definitely developing it throughout F1 and F2. I think I'd seen quite a few cases throughout F1 that really stuck with me, and a lot of them were patients that became palliative and passed away. And even throughout F2, it was always something that was like just really in my mind, and it was a part of my practice that I really wanted to improve. And I think it was an aspect of being a doctor that I hadn't really considered very much until I started working, that a fair amount of your patients like will come to pass whilst you're caring for them, and that's not a failing. But what is a failing is if you've not done your best to kind of help them have as much control of that process as they can.
Yeah. And also to consider what the ceiling of like care needs to be for them. Because actually, I think if I explore my mindset during my F1 compared to towards my end of my F2 when I was doing care of the elderly, actually, like in my F1 year, I remember doing lots of like procedures I just wouldn't be doing anymore as an F2, because actually there's so little you can do to reverse what's an inevitable process. I don't think I had that realization, and I don't think we'd learned it very much in med school at all, particularly when you're not supervised on a ward. You might just do ABCs, you might be doing bloods, you might be trying to assess the patient too much, getting portable chest x-rays, when actually all of that probably won't give you the answers that you're looking for.
No, and actually, like, the patient is dying, and that process is going to happen irrespective of the things that you do, but the things that you do may not change that outcome.
Mm-hmm.
And
the best thing is make sure they're comfortable and make sure that their family are aware and coming to hospital if they're able to. So just a very different mindset, but you have to develop it. It's not something that happens overnight.
It's like a professional maturity almost, right? Like the more you work, the more you start to understand that. And I remember one of my favorite consultants from F1 once sort of turned to me about a patient that we had that was really sick and said to me, like, are they dying? And when do you think they'll die? And I was like, I haven't got a clue. And he was like, it's one of the hardest questions in medicine. He's like, to be able to look at a patient, assess them and say, okay, you're going to pass away in months versus weeks versus days versus hours.
Yeah.
Because actually, like, that's really quite important for someone to be able to kind of gauge
mm-hmm.
what they want and who needs to be there and what needs to happen.
Yeah.
And palliative care are excellent at being able to give a reasonably realistic kind of guesstimation of that. Yeah. So anyways, palliative care was like pretty up there on my list, and I did a taste a week in it at the end of F2, which I loved. Mm. But I think, so I've obviously, well, I don't know if I've mentioned this, but I've been on an obs and gynae rotation out here in New Zealand.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I've really loved it. And I think I've kind of come to the decision that it's my connection with the patients, the fact that I get to, you know, be practical and procedural is great, but also mm-hmm. communication and sort of a psychology side of things is really important in this specialty too. And that's something that I love.
Mm-hmm.
So I can bring that to the table. But I'm going on to doing renal next. So there'll be a lot of palli care input there. So there's a small smidgen of a chance that I might do that and say, oh no, I love palli care, and change my mind. But I think it's unlikely. I think,
yeah. Oh, that's so interesting. And I suppose there's still a lot of palliative care that you will have to encounter in obs and gynae as well. So it'll be interesting.
Yeah, definitely. There's obviously gynae onc, and there is aspects of that mm-hmm. where, you know, you get sort of palliative side of things. Yeah. So,
and I think,
yeah,
actually sometimes we can sometimes be too hesitant in making decisions about our career, whereas before probably the issue was jumping too fast onto a training program, because actually the thing is,
yeah,
if you go into obs and gynae, you're going to have a wide variety of jobs that you can end up doing. And actually looking at two obs and gynae consultants, their job roles can be so different. So it's
exactly
on what you want to do and how you shape your career. So I'm excited for you, and I hope you stay like artistic and you do all like your singing and your writing and all of that as well through it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Wicked.
Of course, I've got to.
You do. So what I really wanted to find out from you is your experience of the New Zealand healthcare system and whether you feel like it's supportive for junior doctors and what you think we could learn from it over here in the UK, or vice versa, really. I know it's quite a big question.
Well, it's difficult because I think that we have very different pressures in the UK, like purely based on number of patients that we have compared to New Zealand.
Okay.
But I would say that their juniors are a lot more supported here. So you know how we've got a news chart, right? And when it triggers a certain number, they're supposed to call a certain person, but actually in reality, like, you just get called. And it's like, why are you getting called as the F1 or the F2 on call to manage a patient with a news of like 12? But it's because we're too busy. It's because the reg is literally fighting fires left, right and center.
Because that happened yesterday, and then we had a patient and it was musing 11.
Yeah,
I remember. And they called F1, and the F1 went over, but I was like, why would you call her? Because they call the F1 because it's the easiest person to speak to.
Yeah,
but I'm just like, just speak to me, because I know what this patient, I know what the ceiling of care for this patient is, and this F1 is going to do, poor F1 is going to do absolutely everything. Whereas I know I'm just not going to do very much.
Yeah.
And just watch. And it was so weird looking back at what I used to be like.
Yeah.
And to think, oh my God, you've got so much to learn. Not in a like a patronizing way. Just
in a just life experience way, right? Like, it's just experience.
Exactly. So it's actually sometimes not good for the patient, for F1s to be called immediately.
No.
It needs to be more senior team. Anywho,
yeah, and here they're quite good at doing that, so they call generally the appropriate person. Secondly, I would say that actually the juniors here are a lot more like it's just a bit more like they're a bit more covered. So for instance, the new doctors are starting next week. So the new med student, the new grads are starting, and they won't do nights. They won't do nights for the first 3 months, 3 to 6 months, I believe. They don't do any nights.
That's important.
Yeah. Cause imagine us, remember like the first lot of F1 that started on nights, and it was just like, we were all like, oh my God, good luck.
Yeah, I started my nights in my first month of work and I was like, what the heck am I even doing?
Yeah, whereas here they don't do nights for 6 months, which is quite nice because you get used to the hospital, you get used to the system, you develop some clinical acumen, and then you start doing things like night shifts where you're, you know, a bit less supported. Also, they have a buddy system here where, like, pre-existing, so you get paid a bit. So if you're a more senior, F1 or a more senior doctor, like, say still like a SHO, you can go in for a on-call shift with the F1 equivalent, and they do the shift, but you're there if they need to ask you a question or just kind of get some like basic advice from where they might not want to call the reg.
So
I know. So,
and that's like, what a safe way of working.
Yeah, it's basically like doing a shadowing on call or something, because there's like someone who does this all the time kind of on the side, maybe just to run by, like, oh, how should I prioritize my jobs, or oh, do you think I should do this, or like, do you think that's okay?
Even silly questions that it'll take you about 10 minutes to like Google and find out, like, you know, when you're like, what's the dose of levofloxacin, do I give it as a BD dose, do I give it as a, do you know,
yeah,
does it matter, is the bioavailability the same? And I'm like, yes, just give the PO 500 milligrams BD. Yeah, that's so much quicker than like trawling through stupid sheets of paper,
or like bothering your reg, or being like, oh, should I ask them, shouldn't I ask them, oh, let me just leave it for tomorrow. Or even little stuff like what the phosphate is 0.6, what should I get?
Nothing, mate. Exactly, stuff like that. It just makes it so much easier to ask someone who knows the experience of working in the hospital, because it's not clinical knowledge.
No,
bits and pieces. Yeah.
So that's nice. Like, I think they're quite well supported here with stuff like that. And also here,
might be a like complete lie. Do you guys get food?
Yes, we do, mate.
Sorry, I can't even breathe.
It's so good. We get food. We get free food. It's so good.
What do you mean by free food? Because I'm not even understanding, really.
So it's kind of like, so there's whispers that maybe it's deducted from the salary, but that's not very, I don't think it's actually officially deducted from the salary. I think it's negotiated in the contract. So whilst you're working, whilst you're on a shift at work, they would provide you meals that you will require during that shift. So they'll provide you lunch during a normal day shift. On a long day, you get lunch and you get dinner. If you're working nights, they give you dinner.
You get dinner?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
You order your dinner and then you pick it up from the fridge.
I bet you were living your best when that happened.
It's so great. It's so great.
And it's so important because it's so hard to buy food in the hospital, and you can just be eating rubbish as well.
Exactly, exactly. So yeah, that is pretty cool. So we get fed and watered. They are generally, yeah, the you're just generally a bit more better supported. And also I would go as far as to say that you get slightly more sort of opportunities, but that's also probably because we worked in London. So it's quite different.
In what sense?
For us, it was quite competitive to like be able to do stuff because there's so many people around. So you wouldn't get to go to theatre as much or stuff like that. Whereas here, I would say perhaps slightly more opportunities to
the training for juniors.
Yeah, I would say so.
Yeah, that's good. And also quite juniors as well, it sounds like. It's not just like if you are a training obstetrician, it doesn't
sound. No, whereas say like I, as a just an SHO, have been able to get a lot more exposure in obs and gynae. But also, yeah, I guess that's very hospital dependent. So I can't really comment on that as a generally for New Zealand. But
no, that's really cool. That's really cool. Yeah. So you make me want to come to New Zealand and do obs and gynae. This is like crazy.
You gotta get on it.
I need to figure out my life somehow. But I'm gonna start figuring it out so I've applied for a pediatric job.
Oh yeah.
I can't even speak. I applied for a pediatrics job at our old hospital.
Yeah.
So I've got my interview coming up for that. But I have to do a Skype interview. So it's lucky we downloaded Skype today.
Good.
so at least I'll know whether I want to do peds or not. I think that placement will help me figure it out. So we shall see.
I think I hear some doors clattering, so I think my Game of Thrones viewing party is about to kick off. So I think we've got to wrap it up.
We do. So what are you guys doing tonight?
So we are literally, there's a bunch of UK doctors out here. We've all kind of become really good friends. And we're basically re-watching Game of Thrones from the start in anticipation of the final season in April. So,
You crazy people. What a waste of time, but I love it.
Amelie is like so not into Harry Potter and Game of Thrones. She always is like, you Harry Potter chicks.
It's because you guys are obsessed with Harry Potter. I've read and I've watched every single book and movie.
But you don't understand. You don't understand that it's a way of life, Amelie. You know?
Sorry, I'm done with this conversation. Okay. She's super. And can I just say, Suba doesn't call me. It's always me having to call her or figuring out how her life is.
That's a lie. No,
this is why I do the podcast, just to kind of keep it up with Suba.
That is pure jokes. Well, anyways, I'm looking forward to recording our episode where you tell me about your life and update me on living in Devon and all the things that you've been up to.
And how to make money as an F3.
Stay tuned.
So, see you guys. Thank you so much, Suba, for calling me at such early hours.
Thank you for waking up at this time and navigating the world of technology.
Thank you. I tried. All right, see you later, guys.
All right, bye. See you guys later. Bye.
Catch us over on www.afterthelettersafterthelettersafterthelettersafterthelettersafterthelettersafterthelettersafterthelettersafterthelettersafterthelettersafterthelettersafterthelettersafterthelettersafterthelettersafterthelettersafterthelettersafterthelettersafterthelettersafterthelettersafterthelettersafterthelettersafterthelettersafterthelettersafterthelettersafterthelettersafterthelettersafterthelettersafterthelettersafterthelettersafterthelettersafterthelettersafterthelettersafterthelettersafterthelettersafterthelettersafterthelettersafterthelettersafterthelettersafterthelettersafterthelettersafterthelettersafterthelettersafterthelettersafterthelettersafterthelettersafterthelettersafterthelettersafterthelettersafterthelettersafterthelettersafterthelettersafterthelettersafterthelettersafterthelettersafterthelettersafterthelettersafterthelettersafterthelettersafterthelettersafterthelettersafterthelettersafterthelettersafterthelettersafterthelettersafterthel Network.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.